This year in Retronauts, it's 1996 all over again. Hi, everyone. Welcome to our now annual extravaganza, 30 years of the greatest RPG of all time. Note the asterisk. So, we are the Retronauts, and I wish to say hello and welcome. Yeah, we've got our little hello song. Okay, so
you heard it.
We are some of the Retronauts. Some of them are not here, but they are here in spirit, haunting the halls, begging for cheese curds, as is the Wisconsin way. Who are we? Starting down at that end.
My name is Diamond Fight. You want stars? I'll give you stars. 7 stars.
Diamond, you have a picture here, a portrait of you.
Really?
Isn't that amazing? I customized this presentation.
Oh my goodness.
Us. I could have just downloaded it offline and plagiarized something, but I customized this one.
Exciting.
Here also, next to me.
Hello, I am Nadia Oxford, and apparently I am Stitch because I spit a lot and my venom is probably poisonous.
I can confirm the last part. And I am Jeremy Parrish. Elderly, but I have many tutorials for you. If you've played Chrono Cross, which is coming up in the greatest RPG of all time in 4 years, you'll know all about that one. Here's some interesting facts about us. Anyway, so 2 years ago, we brought you the greatest RPG of all time, Final Fantasy III, which some smart, cool people know is actually Final Fantasy VI, but sometimes we call it III because life is confusing that way. Then last year, we remembered it was the 30th anniversary of an even greater RPG of all time, Chrono Trigger, and we had to talk about that one and give it its due respect because it's the greatest RPG of all time. But now it's the year 2026, and we've been reminded that it is, in fact, the 30th anniversary of the greatest RPG of all time, so we have to wipe those last two off the board. Forget you were ever here. Forget you ever heard us talking about those. We pulled the trigger too soon. Here, looking back at 1996, we can tell you what really was the greatest RPG of all time. It was... Oh my God, what is happening
what is
here?
Oh.
This is shenanigans, yes. This is a secret Retronauts Hootenanny presentation. If you are familiar with the Hootenanny, it's where a bunch of us get around and scream at each other for about 2 hours, and eventually decide here, in this list of games that we have come up with, which of those stands at the top and which rots at the bottom. Although all of these are the greatest RPG of all time, and therefore none of them truly deserve the bottom ranking, but we have to fight our way through, figure that out, and part of that is incumbent on you, the fourth participant in this conversation, to decide. Actually, it's entirely on you because there's not enough of us. There's not enough games here for us to really come up with a good, beefy presentation.
You really outnumber us. You could probably kill us.
Yeah, so we're going to... Oh, I forgot to check to see if my decibel meter is actually downloaded. We're gonna rely on all of you to help us figure out which is the greatest RPG of all time. As soon as I figure out how to find my decibel meter. There we go. Decibel X. There you go, my little friend. Okay. So, look forward to this. Your volume, your cheers, your enthusiasm will ultimately determine what is the greatest RPG of all time from the list that we presented momentarily ago. Yes, we leave it to you to decide. We make our cases, then you vote. There is a small disclaimer here. There are other RPGs that were released in 1996, but they are not the greatest. You may think that you love Beyond the Beyond, but I'm very sorry, you're wrong. So anyway, we're starting here with Super Mario RPG, Legend of the Seven Stars. That is the correct title, correct?
That's one of the titles.
It has been 30 years since I have played that game because it was the greatest and it just left a lasting impression with me that I've carried a lifetime, or at least three-fifths of a lifetime. So I'm just going to let Diamond take it away from here. There were not notes for this. Normally I put together very concrete, detailed presentation images, but things were assembled in haste, and therefore I'm just going to let you see some Mario RPG goodness while Diamond talks about the goodness of Super Mario RPG. There's a little Yoko Shimomura happening here. Not enough to get us a copyright strike, just enough to set the mood.
You know, I thought about it. So usually when you play an RPG, right, usually, you start off with this blank slate of a character. You know, maybe they're a teenager with spiky hair. Maybe they're some kind of secret agent. But they're just somebody. And you get to meet them because you're playing the game for the first time. And you get to know them through the story and how they interact with people. You know, they wake up in their mom's house or they go in their job, and that's just how you meet them, right?
Yes.
Super Mario RPG has, frankly, the unenviable task of saying, okay, here's a bunch of characters who are already iconic. We're going to tell a story about them, and we're going to try to do something different. And we're going to try to make these, you know, basically icons into actual characters. And they actually kind of do it. They kind of get it right.
I would actually argue that this might be the first time in a video game where these characters actually have a personality.
Yeah, I would say that.
Except Mario, who's just like,
he does the pantomime.
But that's what's so great. So they take these characters who, you know, have just the barest of you know, essentials to them, you know, and they really do fill them out, and it all kind of makes sense, you know? You've got, you know, the Koopa, the evil villain who's been kidnapping this princess over and over again for, you know, at least 10 years by the time when this game debuted. And what is he? Well, he's a blowhard, he's a jerk, but he's also not dumb. Yeah. He recognizes that the situation in this, you know, the situation of the game is that, oh my God, a giant sword crashed through my house. I gotta get rid of the sword. Maybe it's in my best interest to hang out with these guys who have fooled me time and again and just see if we can all work together for change.
So the thought there is that Mario keeps screwing things up for Bowser, so Bowser feels that by weaponizing Mario, he can screw things up for the people that he hates.
Yeah, yeah. And even then, I also like Koopa the entire time describes Mario and Peach and all the others, like, they're his minions.
Yeah.
Like, somehow, he's the leader of this group that he basically decided. And but also, everyone around him in the game is kind of like, yeah. We know you love to talk big, Koopa. Like, so everyone around him already knows what he's like. And that's kind of brilliant. Peach is a little less clear because she again gets kidnapped at the start of the game.
She was still Toadstool too. That was her last appearance as Princess Toadstool.
But eventually she gets, you know, she sneaks out of the castle, she goes with you, and her moves suggest, you know, a deep emotional, you know, river is flowing beneath her. Like her maximum attack is just a giant bomb she throws, and it's supposed to represent her rage, I think. Like all the
so they were laying the grounds for Super Princess Peach here a decade in advance.
Possibly. Hmm. I feel like there's. And then you mentioned Mario. Okay. So yeah, Mario in this game. This came out in Japan. I want to say March '96. I don't know about the English version, but
it came out in May. I remember that distinctly.
Okay. So either way, this game was out before Mario 64 came out.
Yes.
So before that game gave us, you know, Wahoo and So Long, Gay Bowser and all that stuff. This was like a big moment for Mario as, like, you know, coming out and being, like, having a personality. And instead, he's basically a silent protagonist, except he's also, like, a chaos gremlin who shapeshifts. And, like, remember the Return of the Jedi when C-3PO retells the story of everything that's happened so far, but he's telling it in Ewok, and he's using all the sound effects, and he's doing a great job? Mario does that in this game. He will instantly transform his body into someone else and demonstrate what's been happening to other people in the game so they know what we know. And it's so weird. And also, everyone also recognizes him right off the bat. Like, oh my God, it's Mario. It's the Mario. Like, he's the Batman or something.
is this the game that entered? No, people don't recognize the Batman. He's an urban legend. He's a myth.
He's got a reputation. This squat little.
Is this the game that introduced the term Green Mario to our lexicon?
No, I think that was
just green
one
guy.
Of the paper ones.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, he. everyone's
even
like
Luigi though. Luigi, sir, not appearing in this game. When you get to the later level where you're in like the star area and you're reading like people's wishes.
Yeah.
There's a star you can just find it by accident, and it's like, I want to be a better person like my brother. I want to help my brother. And it's like, this is clearly Luigi's wish. Luigi, who's not even here, is getting character moments in this game. what an abundance. What an abundance of storytelling they had.
There was something that was kind of bothered me a little bit about Mario RPG, even though I adore the game. But I always was a little bit annoyed by the fact that Geno, everyone loves Geno. I love Geno. He's so cool. But there was definitely a Square Enix there kind of downplaying how, like, oh, Princess Peach got kidnapped again. What a silly girl. And then just, like, the kids playing with the dolls, and Geno's the really cool one who kills everyone, and Bowser's a chump, and Mario's a chump, and...
Well, Nadia, I gotta tell you something.
Okay.
They made two new characters for this game. You know, you got Mario, you got Peach, you got Koopa. They give you two other characters. One of those characters is awesome.
Pardon me.
The other character is Geno.
Oh!
That's right.
Oh!
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. This is a Mallow first panel, okay? Mallow is a noble, pure being, okay? Raised by frogs, assumes he is a frog, doesn't look anything like a frog, doesn't care. When he finds out he's not a frog, you know what? He's super excited to meet his new family. He loves all his family. He's got magic powers. He's got stretchy arms. He's not afraid to cry.
Indeed.
What a man or being. I don't know if he has a gender in the game, but he is... What a specimen Mallow is.
A great specimen, yeah. And also you have that just that whole part of the RPG with the in the Cloud Kingdom. I love Dodo.
Yes.
I love everything about Dodo.
Oh,
he's so
yes.
Perfect.
Yes, a one-off villain who just sort of shows up, but he's so adorable. He's an adorable henchman. And yet he's still kind of scary. He's got the big beak.
He's got the big toucan beak and the big fat body. He's just perfect.
So Mallow's name, that's a reference to the fact that he's actually related to Tober Mallow from Foundation series, without whom Harry Seldon's plan would have failed, right?
Yes. Yes.
Certainly correct.
Absolutely.
Definitely, that's why he got that name. Sure.
I'm positive you're correct.
I'm really uncomfortable, by the way, with the naked under the cape thing that you wrote for Geno. I mean, I know it's true, but you shouldn't say it.
Ultimately, everyone's naked under something.
I mean...
No, but he walks... Okay. But Mallow walks around, and he is a being, and he has pants. It's like it's the opposite of Donald Duck, right? He's a character, and he's got pants on.
He jumps out of his pants, dude. He's just like, whoop, I'm casting magic. I don't have pants now.
Compare that to Geno, who walks around and he's got this silly little cap on and this big flowing cape, and then it's just nothing under there except for all this wood. Like, what's going on there? I don't trust Geno.
We're not working blue here.
I don't trust Geno, okay? Don't trust him. He says he's from outer space. That's no reason to take him for his word.
There's no reason to walk around naked if you're from outer space. If you're an alien, put some clothes on.
He should know better.
No shirt, no shoes, no service.
No stars.
No stars.
No stars.
We've got the characters down. Is there anything else that's interesting about Super Mario RPG? Diamond, do you know about timed hits?
Yes.
Oh, did you say timed tits?
We're not working blue.
I'm sorry. That's the one I swear I'm good from now on. Sorry.
You better watch out. He knows about timed hits.
Exactly.
Yes.
There we go.
But again, do I know about them? Yes. Can I execute them regularly? No. We've talked about this on the air many times. I am a rhythm-deficient human.
Oh, really?
I don't know if I need to see a doctor about this, but I do not have a rhythm. I do not understand how dancing works.
I do not understand clapping. People make jokes about white people like not having rhythm. I don't get them because all their jokes are couched in rhythm-based adjectives, and they don't make sense to me. You know, ones and twos and threes and fours. What are you talking about? I don't know what that means. But this game does. This game has a very clear. I think in general, what the game does, they clearly thought about this. Like, okay, we want this game to appeal to people who maybe don't play RPGs. So we're going to take all the stuff that's in RPGs that you know we like, and we're just going to make it real easy to understand. We're going to make this a very easy bar to clear to play this game. You know, all the characters you meet them all pretty early. You can switch them around. It's really not a big deal. All the, you know, instead of having every character with their own magic meter or whatever, they all have a group pool of flower points. And that's all your magic. And any one character can refresh that with an item, and then everyone else can use the points. It's so much easier than having to worry about, oh, my white mage is running low on MP, I gotta have someone refill them. Like, no, it's just a pool that you can all use. And yeah, when you attack, or when you are attacked, if you press the button at the right time, the game gives you a generous bonus.
Yes.
Which I really appreciate when I get it right.
Even on healing items, correct?
Yes.
Everything. Yeah. I think everything in the game does something.
You get a lot of freebies, too, when you spend items. This game, actually, I don't think gets enough credit for bringing people into RPGs the way that Final Fantasy VII did. Like, I can speak for my husband. He was not really into RPGs, but he loved Mario. So he gave the game a chance, and he loved it. And I think that a lot of people who are like, maybe, like, okay, well, I know Mario, I know action games. I guess let's give this a try because, you know, it kind of implements action into the RPG mechanics. And it worked really, really well. To this day, timed hits and the variations thereof is a huge foundation of battles, basically.
So, Diamond, you might be burying the lead a bit because, you know, Chrono Trigger was, we thought, the greatest RPG of all time because it combined Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest. But here we have a game that combines Final Fantasy and Mario, which is an even better selling franchise than Dragon Quest. So, you know, sales equals goodness, right?
Oh, all the time, every single time.
I just think I'm kind of just amazed at how good Mario RPG does and how well it handles what really should have been more challenging sort of tasks, and it just sort of nails them all across the board. It's not that long. You know, it gets started, you get go along. You know, I guess the story is not amazing, okay? The story is not amazing.
It's cute. It's
you know,
cute.
We've had this whole thing about searching for stars before, but just overall, I feel like it really is an incredible blend of characters you already know, but making them feel way more personable and amusing and entertaining in a way you never saw them before.
You also have to fight against Culex, which was a lot of fun. You get a remix of the Final Fantasy IV boss theme. And that's actually quite a difficult battle. That challenged me when I was a youngster. Also, the fight against Jinx, was it? The little guy in the dojo? Like, that was a fierce
little
fight.
The little thing in the... Yeah.
Little thing.
What is that? Was it a vegetable?
I think it was a little turtle or something. It was a flea.
It's very small.
It's very small.
It's very small.
Yeah, this is... you know... I mentioned Final Fantasy because how can you not? But it's kind of significant to look at this and see Square and Nintendo teaming up because a year later, they would be very much at odds.
Yes.
1997, maybe even before that, we go into the year, Square saying, hey, you know that Final Fantasy VI demo thing that we did on SGI purportedly because it would make a great conversion to Nintendo 64. That's not actually happening. We're going to hang out with Sony now. They're going to give us discs to put video games on. We're not with those lowly cartridges that Nintendo has anymore. We're going to be Nintendo's enemy and Sony's best friend. And Nintendo's boss said, they are our enemy. And I don't believe that Square and Nintendo worked together again until after he retired.
Put it this way, when I saw the Cloud reveal in Smash, that's when I realized, oh my god, it finally feels like the rift has mended, because it was pretty deep for...
You can play the Final Fantasy VII Remake on Switch 2 now. That's... I mean, if you had... I don't know, just remembering the opposition that the two of them had.
It was a big dilemma for myself, because I was a big Nintendo fan, also a big RPG fan, and I was reading in magazines that, about this whole like split up that was going on, but I figured, well, they're working on Mario RPG, so maybe it's not true, because I didn't really get how stories were timed back in the day.
Yeah, there was a lot of sniping in the press. You know, Nintendo's president, Hiroshi Yamauchi, saying that role-playing games, we don't really care about those. They're for depressed children who dye their hair brown and stay home and play video games by themselves.
Like
no, it was very rude, but also true. And we didn't appreciate that. But, I mean, here's evidence right here that they don't have to be like that. That you can make an RPG that is incredibly accessible, that captures the spirit and the essence of Mario in a way that is extremely simple and intuitive, and yet still has a lot of complexity, substance, and depth. And it walks a really, really tricky tightrope. That's my pitch for it, even though this isn't my game to pitch for.
That's all right. I accept your help.
any final thoughts before we move along to our next victim topic?
I will say very quickly, I said this earlier to you guys, but Happy Parade, the ending theme for that game is so perfect. And if you have a Switch, play the remake. It's actually a really, really good remake. One of the best remakes I've ever played.
So, final case.
It's a great RPG. It's a great Mario game. It's a good first RPG, although not quite as good as Final Fantasy Mystic Quest.
Yes, what a shame that we hadn't started talking.
That was 96, so we don't talk about it.
What a shame that we hadn't started talking about the greatest RPG of all time in time for that one. Moving along. That was pick one. We'll take your votes later. But now it's time for pick two, Suikoden. Or, if you're nasty, Genso Suikoden.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Suikoden.
A lot of people back in the day called it Suikoden. And I actually made a lot of money in the early days of eBay by doing searches for Suikoden misspelled. And there would be these auctions that no one bid on because they misspelled Suikoden in the title. This was before they had auto tagging and stuff. And I would buy like Suikoden 2 for $20 and sell it for $200. Maybe not quite, but it was a good way to bring in a little extra income when I was out of work. I have no regrets. Nadia, here's your treatise time. I'm going to play some footage.
All right.
This is just a random slice of Suikoden not letting you actually make a choice.
Yeah. Well,
don't hold that against the game, though.
First of all, I think we all have to celebrate that box art, that amazing, amazing box art from the original release for the first game in North America. And you all say, like, oh, God, no, that's an abomination. And you're right, but you don't get abominations like this anymore. Like, this is just pristine. This is perfect. So that's point number one. You can't go wrong with that box art. Suikoden itself is a story that is, most RPGs are kind of like, well, here's a teen coming of age, here's a war that's going on. Suikoden kind of combines those two. It kind of makes it like children who are caught up in the war machine, especially with 2, which has kind of a horrific start to it. And in fact, the narrative of Suikoden 1 feeds directly into Suikoden 2, which is one of the greatest RPG stories of all time, in my opinion. But
it's not one of the greatest RPGs of all time, because that's...
No, because that only happened in 1996.
Suikoden, yes.
Yeah, yeah. I think that also Suikoden really showed off where 32-bit RPGs might have gone if we hadn't descended into polygonal sin. You had 6 people on the field, all beautifully animated. You had them all often attacking at once with all these varied attacks. No slowdown, no nothing. You had these really cool magic effects. Yeah, and also in the same vein, 108 recruitable characters, like... You thought that Final Fantasy VI had a lot of characters that were recruitable? No, no. In fact, this is based on the... Suikoden itself is based on the... loosely on the Water Margin, which is a classic 14th century Chinese novel, which is about a group of 108 outlaws that rebel against the government or the authority. So quite topical, quite timely, and still topical. And it was kind of unusual, even at that time, to see like a RPG with such an a strong Asian influence, because even then I think that people were more into the Western style cyberpunk, even more D&D based settings were still very popular at the time. So even though it was kind of a small tribute, it's just like pretty cool that they put that in there.
Yeah, I mean Suikoden, the world it encompasses, even though it feels kind of small, it's also very diverse. You have, you know, Millik Oppenheimer's castle. He's got a German name, but for whatever reason, he's like obsessed with, you know, Louis the 14th, you know, the Sun King or whatever. Like his palace is kind of like Versailles full of poisonous plants. So it's very French European. You have, you know, the fishing villages. They feel very Chinese in nature. You have kind of the Central Empire, which is very sort of Western Europe, very like England, especially, and a bit France, but mostly England. It really kind of captures, there's a hidden ninja village that's clearly Japanese in origin.
Hanzo, yeah.
But you're right, there is like a very strong influence from China in here, which was unusual at the time. And this was actually one of the very first games that I'm aware of that was localized by Konami into Chinese. There was a PC version released over there.
Yeah, that's really cool.
And, you know, it's based on one of the first great novels in history, which was the Chinese saga of the Water Margin, which, you know, same as, is that Bandit Kings of Ancient China by Koei, the strategy game? It's a big influence.
Yeah.
Along with Journey to the West and Romance of the Three Kingdoms.
It's kind of a mishmash of a whole bunch of references, especially since I want to point out, it was the first game I played that had Jewish surnames. Like, as a Jewish person, I actually thought that was really cool. Oppenheimer, Silverberg. But this is really, really, really interesting, and I wish I could go back and ask this question. In Suikoden, which is a spin-off series of Suikoden 2, kind of like a FMV game, if I'm not mistaken.
I think it's more of a graphical adventure, actually.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. It stars Nash, who is in Suikoden 2, and his last name is Ledka. His last name is Ledka, as in the potato pancake that you fry up at Hanukkah. And here's what gets me. It has the J. It has the silent J. He didn't have to go that hard, but he put the J in there. I need to know. But either way, I really appreciate the fact that, yeah, you saw Jewish surnames in there. But Konami did that. You also had, Otakon was... His last name is Oppenheimer.
Emmerich.
Okay, you guys are related.
Hal Emmerich.
How subtle. So I also want to talk a little bit about the magic system for this game, which is... it's rune-based. It takes some doing. It takes some time. You can't outfit your characters with anything and everything. You have to think about what you're doing, and you have charges, kind of like the early D&D games versus MP. And this was a really interesting handicap that I think makes Magic special, especially in a time when one of the best games of all time, again, Final Fantasy VI, you could... learn Ultima and like put it on everybody and just blitz the battlefield and kind of win the game that way. And you can't really do that with the music, with the magic in Suikoden.
Yeah, I would say Suikoden has a feel of more of a classic RPG where stat growth is not, it's not explosive.
Right.
And your characters are never really going to hit for insane numbers, and it's really, really difficult. It's actually maybe impossible to build a single overpowered character. It is really a game about an army fighting together, like a team fighting together, and everyone sort of pulling their weight, collaborating together. You know, no one can win this war on their own, but when you have a party of six people, it gets a lot easier. And when you have a pool of, you know, 100 people to choose your team from, some of them, you know, they may just be humble blacksmiths, but when you get five of them together, they have a really cool special attack that no one else in the game does. But then, you know, you have the balance of you get this one super incredibly powerful attack, but that uses up all your turns for, or your actions for that turn, and also the next turn they're dizzy. And you have to balance the fact that you're just going to be vulnerable for an entire turn after unleashing the super attack. So it is a game that is very balanced and very no OP, essentially.
Yeah.
But it encourages you to build out your army, to find ways to customize your characters and try to enhance their abilities as best you can, and also to kind of experiment with different teams, because there's no one or two characters that's so amazing that you're just like, well, I'm always going to use them, and then I don't care about these other people. You can build viable teams no matter what, and there's, you know, fun, surprising combinations that pull together. Like, there's certain female characters who can team up, and they have access to special attacks when they, it's like the beauty attack or something like that?
Yeah, yeah, everyone, like, some of these attacks are really fun. Like, I know it's in Suikoden 2, but there's Gengen, the kobold who rides on the wolf, Shiro, and he has a little bone and he on a string, and he, like, charges as he chases the bone. It's really, really cute. But, yeah, the really interesting thing about Suikoden is some of those 108 people, they really are just regular schmoes. It really gets into how regular people are drawn into war, which gets to my next point, which is all your base are belong to us. Literally, Suikoden is the king of base-building RPGs, in my opinion. You take over a castle. I can't remember if the first one had a vampire or something in there. I don't know if Necrolord was in there. Someone was hanging out.
There was a ghost of some sort.
There's a ghost. There's a jerk. You kick them out, like, this is my castle now. And you just really build it up into a home. And it's especially apparent in Suikoden 2 when you see people, like, just hanging out. You have a unicorn just drinking at the pond, like a unicorn does. And I always liked how the opening cinema for the second game had showed people in the castle, like, doing laundry, like, drinking at the bar. Just made, like, a lot of people, it made everyone feel kind of more human there. And you could name your castle. And I won't say...
It's always Grayskull.
I always named mine... I tend to go with Efrafa. Or I won't say the word because we're not going blue here, but...
That's so on brand.
F-Nut Castle. Here's a little bit of trivia in case someone holds a gun to your head and says, okay, do you know this fact? I interviewed a long, long, long ass time ago. Does anyone remember Epic Mickey on the DS? There was a game on the DS where you could build a base. And the guy I talked to who did that game said he was inspired by Suikoden 2 to make a base like that. So if you want to make a good base in your game, you could do worse than look at a castle that had a vampire living in it once, like a snail. You got to pick him out.
There's even a bathhouse in this castle.
There is.
Your team can hang out, and if you put cursed ornaments in there to decorate it, then it, like, everyone gets cursed when they take a bath, and it's gloomy
it's
music.
Really
it's
funny.
It's
yeah,
really strange.
Yeah. This game also... has absolutely the best depiction of the kobold race. They are just dogs. They are literally dogs. There's a Borzoi, or there's a... I'm giving the thumbs up in the front row. Yep, absolutely. I just want to read their battle cries, which include arf, arf, and grr. And I just love these guys. And finally, there are just like a million and one narratives running through this story, which is primarily about war, but also about the things that are affected by war. For example, you have the Howling Voice Guild, who uses guns, and you have to kind of figure out things with them. You have the Dragon Knights, who are kind of their own kingdom, and it's basically just Dragon Riders of Pern, just kind of took everything from that and made it into their own little guild, but... yeah, it's so cool. And these are things you can miss oftentimes in terms of the story, which is good and bad, depends who you talk to. But the fact that there are these timed story points that you don't have to see, but that's how you get certain characters, that's how you see certain story threads. It's just really cool. Suikoden. Woo.
Diamond, do you have any thoughts you want to add to the Suikoden discourse?
I want to ask an unfair question.
Yes.
Because... the internet at large talks a lot about Suikoden 2.
Yes.
And not so much about 1. So how can Suikoden 1 be the greatest RPG of all time if everyone talks about the sequel obsessively?
Well, we're talking about 1996.
Well, it's because people just take for granted the fact that Suikoden is the greatest RPG of all time. They don't talk about it as much because it's just known, like... This is
a masterpiece. I feel almost like they're one game at this point. Like, Suikoden 1 and 2 tie in so closely that...
yeah.
You do get like a long-ass novel out of it, but it's still a coherent story thread.
So it's like Dune?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh my god, there it is. You have an Atreides there.
I thought, okay, yeah, sure.
If I meant to pronounce that, you can kill me. I haven't watched or read Dune.
No, I thought they said Doom.
Oh, no,
Doom
no.
Doom 1 and 2 also kind of fit together.
Yeah, they do.
All right, any final words before we move along to the final discussion and the voting?
San Dimas High School football rules.
I meant about Suikoden, or is that part of it?
That's part of it. Okay. They have a football team.
Oh. right. So now we're moving on to the third and final topic, Revelations Persona. I've put this presentation together. You may notice that the tenor and structure of this portion of the panel is a little different, but I will have some footage in here of the game, just so you can kind of see what Persona is all about. I don't know, how many people have played the original Persona versus the later ones? All right, so you know what's up. It's a first-person RPG, but also not. And, you know, it's got a phenomenal localization.
It does.
So Revelations Persona was released, as so many games were, in 1996, and it was the first game in the Shin Megami Tensei series to reach the U.S. Okay, not actually the first.
Yeah!
But I don't think when you say Megaten, anyone's like, oh, yeah, 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 twin-stick shooter in a dungeon.
Hee-haw.
That's my Megaten. So we have Jack Brothers on Virtual Boy, which I believe is now on Nintendo Switch Online. Is that correct?
It is. I love the fact that this was the first Shin Megami Tensei game to come to the West. That is just, like, one of my favorite facts of all time.
Okay, but this is the first real one, except it's not actually because it's not Shin Megami Tensei. It's Ibun Roku, I believe. Diamond, do you know?
Not off the top of my head.
Oh, okay. It was actually like a Splinter side series, but then it kind of got absorbed back into Shin Megami Tensei anyway. So what's so interesting about this game? Well, when it landed in 1996, it was a very different kind of RPG than Americans had seen before, both in terms of the way, like the place that it took place in, the setting it took place in, and also in terms of kind of how it played. It was a game set in contemporary urban Japan. And there had been some, you know, modern day-ish RPGs released before, even on consoles. You had Earthbound.
Mm-hmm.
But this one really felt like it belonged to the school setting. Like, it made sense that the heroes were teens because they encounter all the strangeness that, you know, enters their world through their school. And a lot of the things that they do in the game are consistent with them being students. You know, they go to school, they go to classes, they go shopping in the local plaza mall. They go and they do shopping like at pharmacies.
I always appreciated that, yeah, about, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, it's fine.
But I always appreciated that about that series of game, just that, okay, the world's ending, but my grades, man. What is my if my grades tank, people won't like me.
Yeah, the later Persona games really lean into that,
yeah.
Where you have to kind of manage your time and your class coursework and so forth. And, you know, Persona 3, you can go into the dungeon, but you can't spend too much time there because then you'll be tired the next day and miss classes, and it'll be bad for your overall growth as a human being.
They definitely got more forgiving with that about
yeah.
that.
Yeah, but also, you know, a lot of role-playing games revolve around encountering rough types, and there's plenty of that. There's kind of like, you know, the underworld situation, and you get a lot of friction. You encounter a lot of friction or a lot of dismissal when you go into these rough and tumble places because you are just a bunch of school kids. So it really feels like a game set in the modern world in a way that, like an RPG, that you just hadn't seen before. It really gets away from the fantasy trappings. And, you know, even the weapons that you use. Your kids, the school kids have swords and they have spears, like things you might actually find in, you know, the fencing club or the kendo club, I guess. They also have guns, which you're not just going to find laying around in Japan. But, you know, some creative license is allowed here. But, yeah, you go to a pharmacy to buy healing items. If you ever actually listen to this song all the way through, which plays when you're in the pharmacy, it's just like telling you all the items that you can buy. It's all in Japanese, but it's all the items you can buy and what their effects are.
That's so cute.
Good stuff. Also, it leans into contemporary media. So instead of just pulling inspiration from other video games or from fantasy novels, or from anime, which is very common in role-playing games, especially around this time, it pulls from Western media, like The Velvet Room, which is very clearly inspired by The Red Room in Twin Peaks. And this is hardly the only video game, especially from Japan, to take inspiration from Twin Peaks around this time, but it really wears it on its sleeve. And, you know, the Red Room, The Velvet Room music is kind of famous. It's an iconic element of the series. But here in the original, you can see that the music is actually being performed by the people who live there. So they're singing about how the gum that you like is coming back into style.
All right.
Do you have any thoughts on the contemporary Japan element of it, given that you live in contemporary Japan?
I do, and that's part of the problem. You see, when you live in Japan, you have to make do with the fact that 88% of all media is about high school kids doing high school stuff.
Yeah.
And it comes to a point where if you tell me, oh, this is a great story, it's about high school kids who do high school stuff, I'm gonna close the door in your face unless you really convince me. So Persona as a series is one that's been very hard for me to get into because I'm really tired of high school kids doing high school stuff.
Do you have high school kids? I forget. If
I have one high school kid now. I'll have another soon. That's
yeah.
What they do. They age.
Yeah, they tend to do that.
Yeah.
So, okay. Not so interesting if you live in Japan, apparently. Although, you know, at the time, in America, if we wanted teenagers, high schoolers in media, it was always stuff like Saved by the Bell. And
Degrassi.
I can't imagine Screech just, you know, forging a persona and gunning down a demon.
Zach,
that would
oh
be
God.
A great episode, but I mean, the worst they ever got was the caffeine pill supplement.
Zach, I don't know how to use a gun.
But you're so excited, and you just can't hide it.
You know, Jeremy, it is ironic. I think if the original Persona had come out and actually kept the Japanese storyline thing, I might have been more into it. But, of course, they changed it and made everyone, you know, American.
Yes.
Oh, that's right.
We will get into that a little bit.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Persona, if you look in the history of the Megaten series, it is really a bridge between the original early Megami Tensei games, which were first-person dungeon crawlers and very sort of hardcore wizardry-inspired, and then the modern Persona games, which go much more contemporary Japan, have more of like a third-person, almost like an adventure dating sim kind of element to them. This is sort of smack in between because, you know, it starts out, you're dungeon crawling in a first-person view, but then when you enter a battle, instead of being it being wizardry-style, Dragon Quest-style, you're fighting in more of a Breath of Fire perspective, not Breath of the Wild, although that would be interesting. Also, Persona was the game that introduced to the series Personas, as the title suggests. In the original Megaten games, you recruited demons and basically fought alongside them with your human character. Here, all your party is humans, and they all have personas, which, you know, they're stands from JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, which was very, very big in Japan around this time.
Oh.
Starlight Crusaders, I think, had an adaptation around this time.
There was the OAV in the early 90s, mm-hmm. and the Capcom arcade game was 98. So people who made games in Japan were actively working on JoJo games, or they were just swiping things from JoJo Wholesale and putting them in their video games.
So every character has their own melee weapon, but they have no innate magic. So it's instead when they summon the personas, when they're grafted personas onto their souls or whatever it is, that they gain the ability to use magic spells and other abilities, other uncanny abilities, through these personas. And, you know, you summon a persona anytime you want to use a spell to attack, to buff your party, etc. And also, in addition to that, your personas grant you stat buffs and things like that. They grant you skill upgrades and just make you kind of determine what your combat specialties will be. And you can go into the Velvet Room and you can fuse the personas. You don't even have to do a stupid little dance. You just get the demons that you've gathered in the course of your combat and forge them together through the magic of a guy with a really kind of weird-looking face who likes to play piano named... Is that Igor? It's been a while since I've...
Yeah, Igor's our dude.
Yes. So it's kind of like you fuse these together. It changes the persona that you have. It changes their elemental nature. It changes the kinds of attacks they can use. It changes the stat buffs they offer. It's a lot like giving a beast meat in Saga and making it transform, but it's much less chaotic. The game actually gives you an indication, like, if you combine these two demons, here's what you're going to get. And the fact is, you are talking to demons, you're recruiting to demons. In battle, you don't just have to fight demons, you can also talk to them. If you remember Edge's Doom review that says, as it is, once the power of Doom's graphics has worn off, they're amazing, so give that at least a week or two, you'll be longing for something new in this game. If only you could talk to these creatures, then perhaps you could try and make friends with them, form alliances. Now that would be interesting. Well, Persona lets you do that, Edge. 5 out of 5. There are a few rough spots. This was early days for Atlas, so the localization can be a little awkward. And also, they left out a big chunk of the game in the American localization. There's something called the Snow Queen side quest. And it's not really a side quest so much as if you decide to pursue that storyline, it becomes the game's storyline. And the remainder of the game is this dungeon crawler in a tower where you have to complete the story for the Snow Queen, and that's the end of the game once you're done. If you want to see the main quest, you have to start over. They took that entire thing out. I don't know if it was just a localization resource thing or if they thought, well, maybe it's a little confusing for someone to go into the side story and that become the rest of the game for
them. Yeah, that's what I figure.
But they did restore that 15 years later in the PSP remake. So, despite that little hiccup with Persona, I posit that it is the greatest RPG of all time. Look at all the things that it has given us. Look at the bountitude of wealth, the many personae that have followed up, and the fact that it introduced, really, Megaten to Americans, and starting with the next mainline Shin Megami Tensei game, Nocturne, we started receiving these games that had previously been stranded over in Japan, opening up just a panoply of role-playing goodness for Americans to enjoy. So to me, that is one of many reasons that this game is the greatest RPG of all time. So anyway, which is it? Super Mario RPG, Suikoden, or Revelations Persona? We're getting ahead of ourselves here. What I'm going to do now is ask you all to cheer when I list one of these games. That's what I was supposed to do here. And I've got a cool little decibel meter. We're going to look at the peak that emerges as you cheer, and we're going to base the ranking on this decibel noise. Is that going to be okay? Is it going to cause a problem for the show? All right. Yeah. Go hog wild. Super Mario RPG. So you don't really like that one. All right, you maxed out. It's 99.9 on the decimal meter. I think after that, it just shuts down and says, at this point, your ears are damaged.
It's like the Chernobyl bit. It's not 3 Warnken.
Where is Jared Harris when you need him?
Not great, not terrible.
What?
That was Chernobyl.
Oh. All right, so that was 99.9 for Super Mario RPG. Let's hear it for Suikoden, folks. All right. 97.4.
Aww.
But I think that's just because everyone takes for granted the fact that Suikoden is the greatest RPG of all time and didn't feel like they needed to cheer for it. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. And finally, Revelations Persona. I'm sorry, can we do that one over? I don't think you heard. Let me try again.
Revelations Persona.
All right, so you got your ranking right there. Super Mario RPG, Suikoden. Okay, well, thank you all for joining us this afternoon, this evening, here as a conversation, a contest, a discussion. here at Retronauts. We have another, like, 2 minutes, so I'm going to ask, Diamond, do you have any final thoughts on any of this?
Well, I'm just very pleased that my pick was the winner. Just once again showing that, you know, I know how to pick them.
Nadia?
No matter what happens, no matter who you vote for, the kobolds will always die for you. Arf, arf, grr.
And I think, ultimately, what we learned tonight is that all of you need to go and spend some more time playing Persona to appreciate how frickin' great it is. All right, we'll be back again next year with a look at the next greatest RPG of all time for 1997, but I think we all know what it's gonna be. Yeah.
Good morning. All right, this is working. Hello, everybody. Hello, Milwaukee, or Wisco, I'm
Wisco.
Told. I learned, look, everything I know about Milwaukee, I have learned from Wayne's World or Major League Baseball. And Major League Baseball says it's called Wisco now. So that's what I'm seeing on the internet. Anyway, my name is Diamond Fight. Hello, nice to meet you. I don't appear in the Central Time Zone very often, so get excited. This is a rare opportunity. And joining me today is Central Time Zone resident, Brian Clark.
Hello.
Hello, everybody. So, that's us. That's us. You can see us there. And today, we are talking about Resident Evil, which means we're talking about survival horror, because it's been 30 years. You know, all due respect to Milwaukee Gaming Midwest Gaming Classic, 25 years. Today we're talking about something that is 30 years old, and therefore it is more important. So please, please give me your full attention. Stop shopping over there. I see you. You dropped something, sir.
Everyone drop it.
Pick that up, sir. Don't break it. You break it, you bought it. Don't worry about it. It's okay. Okay, then he owns it. Perfect. All right. So what are we talking about? Survival horror, Resident Evil. First game released in 1986. It's now 2026. I'm sorry if that hurts you. It's the truth. Just live with it. Now, we have 4 points we're going to go over today. Number one, a basic introduction, some basic facts. We're going to go over the features of what we call survival horror, the features that sort of caught on with Resident Evil, and then all the places where I believe those things came from, therefore proving my point. That's what all this is for. It's all to boost my ego. I'm sorry. I'm speaking on a turn here. Let's start with establishing facts, okay? These are the facts. No one can dispute them. So, in 1996, Capcom released Biohazard, a.k.a. Resident Evil, for the Sony PlayStation, March 1996, all around the world. Everyone got it. Now, when you play that game, if you load the game, there's a little loading screen, and the loading screen says, you have once again entered the world of survival horror. It's right there on the screen. And if you bought the game in Japan, it actually is on the box. The box says survival horror, like the genre.
Don't you think it's interesting that actually stuck, though? Because nobody calls Devil May Cry here stylish action. Well, I mean, I do.
Yeah, well, I believe the character is now called Fabulous Action Game, I think.
Is
what's
it?
The featured action?
Okay.
But whatever. The point is, yeah, Japan as a country loves its niche genres. If you go to a Japanese game store and pick up any game that you like,
yes,
you'll probably find that the genre is something oddly specific, like stylish action or, I don't know, constipated puzzle. Like, you never, it's a wonder world. But yes, this word, in fact, did take off. Survival horror. really blew up. So, judging by that, Capcom and Resident Evil must have invented survival horror, right?
Wrong.
Wrong? What does the panel say? Oh, no, it's wrong. I'm sorry. I ruined everything. No. I would argue that, at best, Capcom coined the phrase, but in making the game and drawing from so many other external influences, basically they just kind of mashed a whole bunch of things together, and it just happened to stick. You know, just miraculously, it all worked out. So let's try to define, if we can, how do we define survival horror? It's kind of tricky to define. I don't think anyone agrees on this, so we're definitely getting away from the facts into more of the, you know, opinion zone. Luckily, my opinions are very good. So, first off, this mansion is gigantic, okay? You go inside, you're an isolated protagonist, you're exploring a dangerous, interconnected environment, right? You're walking through doors, you're going through hallways, you're gonna go back in circles, you don't know where you're going, and you're alone. That's always the key, you're always alone. You're probably getting lost, okay? The game is designed to be non-linear. You don't know which way to go. Half of the game is figuring out where to go, and that includes going back to areas you already visited, because maybe now you have something you didn't have before, or maybe now a door opened, or maybe now there's a new monster and the monster has something you need to proceed in the game.
It's kind of funny how that varies based on your own internal sense of direction, though, because I can speak as a person who both in real life and video games has the worst sense of direction imaginable. And I often play at least modern Resident Evil games with a person who is the opposite of me, who internalizes the map immediately. And I get to watch in real time as he becomes incredibly frustrated with me, pulling up the map constantly to reorient myself, whereas he essentially is doing it with his eyes closed. It's very amusing for me.
Well, I must say, the original one didn't do this, but much later Resident Evils, I do appreciate how the map just tells you at a glance whether you've cleaned a room out or not.
Yeah.
I really do appreciate that, because I'm the kind of person who wants to find every little bit, even, you know, even the extra ink ribbons you don't even need anymore. I want to get them and have them.
It's one of the best quality of life features, I think, that they've done in that entire series.
Yes. Because, see, Requiem, by the way, quick show of hands, how many people have played the new Resident Evil Requiem available now? Stars. Okay, small number. All right. I thought it interesting that Requiem, when you pass an item, it puts the item on the map in case you don't pick it up. But otherwise, it doesn't give you any clear indication whether you're done or not. So you have to look. You just have to look carefully.
Yep.
Well, speaking of items, there's items scattered all over the place. That's how you progress in the game. You look. You're gonna, especially in the first Resident Evil. Oh my goodness, you're just gonna run around and you're gonna mash that X button and you're searching randomly for anything you might find. Like, the game does give you little hints sometimes, like a sparkle on the ground. Or maybe there's a little model on top of a desk and you think, oh, that looks like something. Can I pick that up? You can pick it up. Otherwise, it's kind of guesswork, you know? There's so many shelves and bookcases. And, like, you have no idea when you first play the game what's there for decoration and what might actually be important.
And because it's tank controls anyway, you're probably, like, running against the walls at all sorts of angles just naturally. So why not press the button a bunch of times while you're at it to make sure you've gotten everything, right?
And speaking of items, you're going to unlock a lot of stuff. This is a game for master unlockers only, all right? Because as you go around, as you play the game, you're getting keys. Now, some of the keys are just keys, okay? You know, you got your armor key, your shield key, your sword key, sure. Other keys are just tools or weapons that you need to progress in the game, but they also do something else. You know, I'm thinking of in Code Veronica, the pair of golden guns. Like, they're non-functional, but you need them to open a door, and then when that creep Steve takes them, you have to give him a pair of real guns to get his golden guns, and that's how you get pretty good in the game. And then he uses his guns and he waves them around like he thinks he's cool. Steve is not cool, everyone. Please.
I tried to forget about Steve, but now you've ruined my years-long streak of banishing Steve from my memory.
Look, there's a very real possibility we're getting a Code Veronica remake in the next 2 years, so we're all going to have to, as a society, accept Steve as real. Okay? Survival horror isn't real, but Steve may be real. Steve may be coming to a console near you. I'm sorry to tell you this, but it could happen. Where was I? Oh my goodness! Isolated protagonist. Lots of items to collect. Backtracking. Keys and locks. Brian, is Retroid Evil a Metroidvania?
Stop it! No, hold on right there.
Oh my goodness!
Sorry.
It's Metroidvania researcher Kate Willard. Oh my goodness, this is completely unplanned.
Completely unplanned.
Who gave her a microphone?
I don't even know. I don't know where this came from. It was just in my hand.
Come on up here, Kate. You might as well join us at this point. The ruse is out. I bet you thought this third chair was for Elijah the Prophet, but no, it was for Kate Willard the entire time.
Yeah, so if you're unfamiliar with me, my name is Critical Kate. I do a YouTube series called Metroid Mania where I backtrack through the history of platform adventures before Metroid to see if any of them qualify as a Metroidvania by my very strict definition. People have a lot of different definitions of Metroidvanias. My definition involves like it being a platform adventure, but it also has like dual purpose abilities, kind of like you're saying here, might be in some games. But just to be clear, like the first Resident Evil, most Resident Evils, Metroidvania, no.
No?
No.
All right. Well, we got that out of the way. Don't worry about it.
But maybe
let's move on to the next slide. Let's talk about the distinct features of Resident Evil that definitely caught on and made everyone realize they want to make more games like this. So, what do we got here? Well, in case you don't know, I hope you know by now, Resident Evil, third-person action game. In reality, however, it's only 3D in that there are 3D models moving around on top of a 2D background. Now, this does two things. Number one, it fixes all the action to a certain perspective. So whenever you walk into a room, the camera is in a certain place. That's the only place the camera is going to be, unless they make another camera angle for a specific reason. So every time you move between spaces, you are moving relative to an unseen camera that you cannot control. And on that note, you move the character relative to the character, which we sort of call it tank controls. I believe in Japan they call it like an RC car, yeah. And that means if you push up on the controller, you walk forward. You push back on the controller, you walk backward. If you press left or right, you just rotate in place like you're some sort of robot. It's very amusing, but it's very functional. Because you don't know, when you walk down a hallway, you have no idea where the next camera is going to be. So as long as you're pushing up, you'll continue to walk straight down the hallway into the mouths or arms of something wanting to eat you.
And that's not at all obvious when you're playing it, though. Like, it takes you some time to figure that out.
Also important, because everything is a 2D background in reality, when you leave one room and go to another room, you have to pass through a doorway or something, and the game has to load that all data. But instead of a blank screen, the game gives you a little bespoke animation of a door opening or a staircase or an elevator. Whatever it is, they're all unique. It's very charming. I think some people today, because the PC versions let you skip that, I understand why you would skip it if you're doing a speed run. But if you're just playing the game to enjoy the game, don't skip the door animations. You're skipping yourself is what you're doing. You're skipping the game. That's part of the game. It really is. Also important, items, inventory, okay? Resident Evil, much like the restrictions of the presentation define how the game operates, the restrictions of how the characters carry things affects the way the game works, because every character in Resident Evil has a very tight inventory limit. In the original game, Jill has 8 slots and Chris has 6 slots. But more importantly, everything you pick up is gonna be one slot, so if you want a gun, that's a slot. If you want the bullets for that gun, that is a second slot, okay? So if you want to walk around and defend yourself, that's at least 2 slots right there, unless you're a knife expert, but I don't believe those are real because the knife in Resident Evil 1 is really hard to manage. But some people do it, I know.
And no freeloading the bullets in the gun either, that's not allowed.
No, you can't do that.
You have to have the bullets on your person before you can put them in the gun.
That's right, if your inventory is full, and you have an empty gun, and you see bullets on the ground, you can't pick them up.
You can't pick them up.
No. Impossible.
Even now?
I don't think so. They let you combine herbs now?
Even now.
If you find one herb, you can combine it with an herb you already own.
Yep.
But if you find bullets, no. You need a spot to pick up the bullets. You have to. Even saving the game, to save the game, you must find a consumable resource, an ink ribbon, and a special typewriter, and put the ink ribbon in the typewriter, and that's how you save the game. If you use ink ribbons, you cannot save the games anymore. You're done. You just have to cross your fingers and hope you make it. Again, all these restrictions, what do? They make combat very methodical. Because every enemy you find in the game is going to take at least a few bullets, some of them more than a few bullets. The average zombie takes, I think, 7 bullets in the original Resident Evil, which is like half a clip. So like when you start the game, you have a clip and a gun, you fight one zombie, you shoot the zombie dead, and you're like, oh wow, that's half of all my bullets. I don't think I can kill every zombie in this house.
The real strats you're supposed to be using there is just learn to juke them, like especially in that first one, like juking those zombies is the most important thing you can learn in that game, right?
Exactly. Like you can go around shooting all the zombies. I think people have done the math and they figured out eventually you do get enough ammo to kill all the zombies. But early on in the game, if you use too much ammo, you're gonna run yourself into a trap. Yeah. You'll be out of bullets. Like, well, now what do I do? That means running away from conflict is often the smart move, and that includes bosses. The original Resident Evil has multiple boss encounters where the smart move is just to run for the door. Don't fight the monster, just run away. It's fine. The monsters can't open doors in the Resident Evil 1. It's okay. But of course, besides the monsters, there's traps. There's traps everywhere. There's poison gas traps. There's things that can impale you. And there's puzzles to solve. Some of the puzzles are also traps. It's funny how that works. But really, the game has set up all these different ways for you to look around, investigate things, and possibly get killed. There are a million ways to die in Resident Evil. I believe the HD remaster even gives you a trophy the first time you die, just because, like, okay, well, that's gonna happen. And most importantly, at least for me, as a nerd who enjoys reading things, Resident Evil is an epistolary storytelling. And epistolary is a very expensive word for writing letters, because in Resident Evil, aside from picking up bullets and herbs and cranks, you're also picking up documents. And reading the documents is how you figure out what is actually happening in this big spooky house. You'll find little notes telling you where to find an item. You'll find little notes telling you about, oh, that door is locked. You need to do this to open the password. And most infamously is the Keeper's Diary, which is a man detailing his own descent into zombie madness, where he eventually eats some guy because his face is ugly.
These are very popular on Instagram and whatnot now, but my favorite ones are not the scientist diaries for the ones who are turning into zombies, but the ones who are like, I created this horrible creature and I put it in a cage and tortured it and poked and prodded it for 2 weeks. I sure hope it doesn't get out. That's diary entry. It got out.
Yeah. They always get out. They always get out. Umbrella, not exactly a secure company. Let's talk about antecedents. Let's talk about where pretty much all this stuff came from before getting put in the blender and called survival horror. So let's start at the beginning. Adventure games, okay? Adventure games as a genre really touch upon a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, adventure games like invented most of this stuff.
Most of it.
That's a fascinating, I could totally derail this whole thing by talking about how we get from adventure games to here.
Well, I think we'll at least touch on the points here. By the way, this is from Sam & Max, Hit the Road, one of the great early adventure games. Very comedic, very funny, still holds up today. Okay, so, adventure games. What do you do in adventure games? You're searching every screen looking for stuff to pick up, interact with. A lot of the puzzles require you to combine two items to get a third new item somehow, or to solve a riddle that maybe the items help you solve the riddle somehow. And many adventure games, especially the older ones, revel, I would say, in escorting you down the wrong path and putting you in a situation where you cannot win. And I sure hope you saved earlier, because otherwise you have to start over. You know?
Similar to the ammo situation.
Yes, yes, I believe so. I do believe so. Next up, this is called Alcazar, the Forgotten Fortress from 1985, a multi-platform, top-down action roguelike. If you look at it, it kind of looks like a Zelda game almost. Alcazar had a limited inventory slots. If you look at the screenshot, there is one item in the character's hand and three items in their pockets. Notice that the guns all have a finite ammo count, when the gun is out of ammo, the gun is out of ammo. Just get rid of it. It's worthless. And of course, if you pick up other items, that means you have to put down one of your guns or one of your other items.
So can I just point out that, like, I don't know if there are any roguelike fans in the audience, but roguelike fans are very strict about what they consider a roguelike, and I feel like there are probably some roguelike fans that are like, no, it isn't. No, it isn't. It might be safe to call this an action adventure, which is like an adventure game where there is like real-time action, you can fight people and stuff. That's where, like, adventure was actually named after a game called Adventure back
on the Atari?
In the 70s.
Yeah.
No, before
that one. Okay, sorry.
Because the Atari Adventure was an attempt by Warren Robinette. He played the first text adventure, which was called Adventure.
Yes.
And he was obsessed with it, and he wanted to try to create a similar experience on the Atari using a joystick that only had one button. So it turns into this different thing that is like the earliest version of what you might call like a Zelda-like now. It was very Zelda-like, and everything that kind of follows in that action-adventure route all feels like Zelda-ish, which I think is why Alcazar also feels like a sibling to Zelda.
Well, anyway, due to this inventory issue and the fact that, you know, the rooms, you don't know where you don't know what's going to be in the next room every time you play because the game reorganizes itself. Again, avoiding conflict is usually the smart move. And in interviews, Kenichi Iwao, who wrote the scenario for the original Biohazard Resident Evil, specifically cited the MSX port of Alcazar as an influence in the development. He said they knew about that game and its limited ammo and finding and the limited inventory, and they're like, oh, we should do that in this game that we're making right now called Biohazard. Although, speaking of Capcom, let's talk about Sweet Home. Oh, torso. No homeowner likes to find a torso. That's one of the worst things you can find. That and termites. Sweet Home, Capcom's very own 8-bit Famicom RPG, never released in English officially. It was loosely based on a movie that came out the same year, but really they're kind of like parallel thinking. Like that, it's a licensed product, so it has the movie poster on it, but the movie and the game are kind of different things. But both take place in a haunted mansion. The game features 5 characters, each with their own limited inventory. I believe each character also starts out with one unique item that only they can use, so you have to sort of figure out where they need to be in certain places. Also, for the roguelike crowd, it's permadeath. If one of the characters dies, they die. That's it. And maybe you can get to the end, maybe you can't.
Which is pretty rare for like a Famicom era RPG.
Very rare. Absolutely.
That wasn't one of the ways in which they were usually punishing.
Sweet Home also has letters for you to find, documents for you to read. And when you open a door to go to a new room, guess what? You get a little 8-bit animation of a door opening and you go through the door.
Can I comment briefly on epistolary storytelling?
Sure.
Like, it pops up so often in like horror games, and I feel like that isn't an accident, because like I'm not sure what the first, I can't remember offhand what the first video game is with it, but epistolary storytelling starts like, it goes back to like novels and things.
Yes.
I think I might be misremembering this factoid, but I want to say Dracula
yes.
might be the first novel that had epistolary storytelling.
So I don't know if it's the first, but it's definitely a very famous like example of it. Indeed, there's a service you can set up for online called Daily Dracula, where they email you documents throughout the year that are dated from the book, so you can basically experience the Dracula novel through your inbox each day. It's very fun. I eventually turned it off because I realized that they were just gonna keep sending it to me forever until I die. So I was like, okay, I read Dracula, I get it, thank you. It's a good service, but I've had enough Dracula, thank you. Not speaking of Dracula, let's talk about Alone in the Dark. Alone in the Dark, 1992. Another game, third person action game, fixed camera angles, tank controls, haunted mansion, plenty of puzzles, traps to navigate, and a limited inventory. Although in Alone in the Dark case, the inventory is weight-based, not slot-based, but still, you have to manage what you're carrying because you can't carry everything at the same time. And this is one that's also been openly cited by the Resident Evil staff as saying, oh yeah, we saw this and we realized, oh, we need to do it like this. This is a good way to do it. As we get closer, we're getting less and less influential and more just like, huh, that exists. Dr. Hauser. It's okay if you know Dr. Hauser. I'm not talking about Doogie Hauser. Do not make the mistake. Dr. Hauser, 1994 for the 3DO. Again, only in Japan. Fan translations exist if you want to play today. Dr. Hauser was a fully 3D game in 1994, exploring a haunted mansion. You could choose between first person or third person, either way, because the whole game is in 3D. If you play it in third person, guess what? Tank controls. Also, there's no enemies to fight in the game, but the mansion is full of deadly things that will just take your head clean off. Very dangerous house. You don't want to explore the house, but you have to explore the house because you're trying to find Dr. Hauser. I forget what your character's name is, but you're looking for the doctor, Dr. Hauser. Next up, D, 1985. We're getting very close to Biohazard now. D was a mist-like adventure game. Again, fully rendered in 3D, you push a button, you walk down a hallway, and you always take the same turns. It takes place in a hospital, but only for 5 minutes, because then an illusion takes place, and you spend the rest of the game in a haunted castle. D also has a strict time limit. You actually cannot save the game. You must beat the game inside of 2 hours, or the game ends. Even if you pause the game, that doesn't stop the game. There's a clock that keeps ticking. But in any case, it's certainly a game that I'm sure a lot of Japanese people, certainly in the game business, must have played at the time. Kenji Ino was already kind of a known quantity, and he would make many, many more weird and interesting games after D. But D, I think, for me, certainly as an early horror game fan, I played that one before I ever played Resident Evil. I was like, whoa, this is wild. They're out to eat me. They want to eat me in this game.
Can I mention one more game that there isn't a slide for?
Okay.
This one is earlier than Alcazar. There is a very survival-y platform adventure that goes back to the 80s. It's for the Apple II. It's called Aztec.
Aztec.
And Aztec, it's a similar vibe where you have limited ammo and there's monsters everywhere. People at the time were saying it seemed like the game Castle Wolfenstein turned on its side, which is an early action adventure for the Apple II that I think influenced a lot of the computer side of people exploring this action adventure realm. And there was something else I was going to say, and thought just disappeared out of my head. But yeah, I think Aztec. Oh yeah, I was going to just comment briefly that something fascinating that I discovered while researching action adventure games that I didn't previously realize, but before Japanese computers took off in Japan, they were importing the Apple II, and a lot of these developers were inspired by imported Apple II games. And so I think Aztec and Castle Wolfenstein possibly were a big inspiration for Japanese developers who did the first horror games, like Alcazar in particular. I would almost put money on that being a game where he had played Castle Wolfenstein.
Really? There's a handful of games that really influenced so many games after that, and Wizardry is usually one that comes up a lot, but yeah. I think there's probably a dozen more that we only are finding out now through secondhand sources, people saying, oh, I played this game. Speaking of which, Clock Tower, late 1995, so again, very close to the Biohazard release date. Originally only in Japanese, you can play it now in English, it's been officially released. But Clock Tower, literally a point-and-click adventure game, okay? Even though you're playing on Super Famicom, you're moving a cursor with the D-pad, and you're clicking on the screen and telling Jennifer where to go. That's how you play it. There's no direct controls. It's also in Haunted Mansion. And when you see an enemy, your first thought is to really run away because they're carrying a giant scissor. And what are you going to do against giant scissor? You don't have a giant rock, okay? I'm telling you right now, there is no rock in that game that will help you.
Run.
Yeah, you run. All right, so what have we learned today? Well,
we've learned that survival horror is less of a genre and more of a blend of pre-existing concepts stuffed together, if you want to say, wearing a trench coat and a little hat, perhaps? Yes, I think we agree. Trench coat and hat, always a good look.
So my personal take, and you're free to disagree with this, but I consider like 99% of survival horror games to be really just action-adventure games with a horror theme. And that survival horror was a name invented similar to stylish action. Like, we don't have to call it that, but it is fun. It's a fun thing to say. I like saying stylish action, to be frank.
Yes. Resident Evil sold so well that a lot of other companies decided they wanted to make their own game like that. So the name and a lot of the particulars of Resident Evil and survival horror suddenly caught on in the late 90s, early 2000s. So we should probably be calling these games Resident Evil-likes or Resident Evil clones instead of survival horror if we want to be, you know, official about it. But on the other hand, it's been 30 years, so just have fun out there, okay? Just enjoy the games. They're really good games. I cannot stop playing Requiem. I think I need a doctor. If there's a doctor who can make me stop playing Requiem, I might need your help.
Hopefully not the doctor in Requiem, though.
Oh, no. Victor can go ride his motorcycle somewhere else. I'm not interested in Victor. Anyway, we're out of time here. Let's wrap things up. So, where do you find us on the internet? You can find me on the internet by looking for Fight Club. F-E-I-T is my last name. C-L-U-B is a word you already know. I have a website, fightclub.me, or go to social medias like Blue Sky, Letterboxd, Patreon, Ko-Fi, Venmo, whatever you want. I'm on there. Brian?
Yep, I'm either VClarkOMP or 1 Million Power on just about everything. 1MillionPower.com has all the links to everything. The YouTubes, the Patreons, the whatevers.
And the easiest, wow, I'm on this slide.
Amazing.
And it's amazing.
It just happened. You didn't see it, but it happened.
Wow.
As soon as you came up here, it changed.
Rewrote history, like I often do. You can find me, the easiest way to find me is just to go to Blue Sky or YouTube or even Google and just type Critical Kate, Critical Kate, and you will usually find something of me, and you can find the rest of my stuff from there.
Is that the end?
That's the end.
No, I have a credit, yes.
Oh.
Credits not for the PowerPoint. The PowerPoint was a template I found online. I am not that skilled at PowerPoint. But yeah, thank you everybody, good night.
Thank you.